This is the third teisho of this June 2014 session. And we'll resume reading from Novice to Master from Roshi Morinaga. We left our main character, Roshi Morinaga, leaving to the monastery after the master tied his laces. And the next chapter, the next chapter is actually when he gets to the monastery, and I'll read only a couple of pages of the description of the process of getting into the monastery, which is quite grueling. To what is relevant to Sesshin today in terms of teaching. Of course. So, this chapter is called The Meaning of Courage. When a monk aspiring to enter a training monastery reaches the entrance hall, he takes off his wicker hat and places it out of the way in a corner, climbs up the steps, and announces himself. In a large Zen temple, there's a vast entrance hall and a step that gives into a wide stretch of corridor beyond. Although there may be dozens of monks in training within the heart of the temple, not a sound is heard in the tomb-like stillness. The monk calls out in a long, loud voice, "I beg your favor," in a form established many long years past. It says many long years past, and you wonder if the long is the years or the past. Better probably many years long past. Sorry, that's my editor coming into the forefront here. The aspirant monk feels his own voice sucked up into the depths of the monastery. Presently, an answer rises from the distance. "Who is it?" A monk appears, wearing a cotton robe and looking very experienced. "Where have you come from?" he demands to know. The young novice places his hands politely behind him on the step, along with papers that he has brought with him. Included in the papers are a record of his own personal history, a letter requesting entering to the monastery, a statement in which he pledges to sacrifice his life for practice, or written with brush and ink and enclosed in an envelope. With great formality, the newcomer states his name, identifies the prefecture, town, and temple from which he comes, and priest under whom he apprenticed. He promises that he has come to this place because he would like to assume the mantle of training and hang his bow, staff, and rope on a hook in the training hall. He then asks that his request be made known. The applicant is bid to wait as the monk disappears into the back. Returning after some time, the monk categorically says, "No, stay. You are most welcome here, please step inside." Instead, without fail, he conveys the verdict that the newcomer request is refused. He might say, for example, that the training hall is full at the moment, or that because provisions in the monastery are extremely meager at this time, another monk could not possibly accommodate it. In my own case, while my present weight is 150 pounds, back then I weighed less than 90 pounds, and appeared to be nothing but skin and bones when I first begged entrance into the monastery. I was turned down with this excuse: "Your health appears to be extremely delicate. You would not be able to keep up with the intense training at this monastery. Please try at another training hall." There are some 40 professional training halls throughout the country, but a monk will be rebuffed wherever he goes. Upon rejection, he takes the envelope, which has been thrust back at him, and retires into a corner, out of the way of passerby. He takes up his post on the step, doubled over, forehead down to the ground, in earnest supplication, until he is granted permission to enter the monastery. This means that he's doing a prostration in the corner without getting up. Because he goes on to explain about Bodhidharma and his disciple, Wiko, known in Japanese as Eka, where he begs for entrance, he begs to become the disciple. Bodhidharma turns him down. "What are you doing here?" he says. And Wiko, he says, "I want to practice the incomparable, marvelous ways of the Buddhas can be attained," blah, 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 blah. "All the elevation that you want for the path." "Practicing what cannot be practiced and bearing the unbearable. How can you, with such meager virtue, little wisdom, with your shallow and arrogant mind, dare aspire to attain the true teaching?" Bosiko was told to get out there with little insight and few resources. I don't know if Bodhidharma actually said that or how he said it, or if this is the Japanese version so that they could be justified in doing what they were doing or are doing today. I don't know if Bodhidharma, being Indian, followed the same but we could cut off his arm at the elbow to demonstrate that he was eager and earnest and sincere in his request for his request to be taken in by the teacher. Bodhidharma, seeing the arm cut, said, "Okay, well, come in." I don't know. I don't know. Well, beyond the historical fact of how it happened, being Bodhidharma, an Indian master, the fact is that the teacher is testing the will of the student to come in, to get into the path. Which is very different from what happens here in the Western Hemisphere, Europe, United States, Mexico, certainly, where we want students, we look for students, we don't do any proselytizing, and we do follow. But if a student comes and says, "I want to practice," it is not acceptable in this culture to ask him to cut off his arm or to beg at the door for 7 days while he's bent over in a prostration. We are slightly more accommodating. So, I think that is more of a cultural difference. But there's something to say, and here is where it gets the reason why they do it. Rooted in this tradition, the rites of passages into practice are, even today, so 1500 years later, extremely rigorous. I knew from the beginning that I, too, would have to comply with the rules of the tradition. Thus, I first crawled through the gate, resigned to undergo the unavoidable ritual. Yet, even as rituals go, this one was a bit rough, a tad. Soon after my initial rejection, another monk emerged wielding an oak stick. Could have been a kind of kyosaku. "Despite the fact that you were just denied entry into this temple," he said, "you persist in making a nuisance of yourself by displaying your unsightly form before our entranceway," he said. "I ask that you immediately leave the premises. Up to this point, the language had been polite enough. But even with this new verbal onslaught, I did not withdraw. I maintained my position, not moving a muscle. "Hey! You! What's the matter? Are you deaf?" The monk followed up his tongue lashing with jabs, kicks, thrusts, and all manners of blasphemy, and I soon found myself hurled bodily out of the gate. When I peeked up and saw the monk had disappeared inside and the coast was clear like a cat out to flinch and resumed my cowering pose on the step. This whole scene was enacted repeatedly. My patience held out in the beginning because I knew this ritual was one I had to weather, somehow. But gradually, as it went on and on, I began to get irritated. Weren't they being unnecessarily rough considering they were dealing with someone who was not putting up the slightest resistance? By evening, however, the sentiments too had vanished, and I was left feeling wretched and painful. Then I grew plaintively sorrow for myself. Why am I letting them treat me like a worn out rag? Why must I hold this miserable posture in front of this blasted doorway? Maybe both my parents are dead, but I could still go back to Toyama, where he was born, and I have a few relatives there left there. I can live without this cruel treatment. All of this and much more ran through my mind. When I was ordained, I felt some measure of determination to carry out with a strong practice. Later, when Roshi told me, "This is Nirvana money. It is for the disposal of your remains," I had made a resolution that sent a chill through my body. Then, when Roshi tied the strings on my straw sandals and urged, "Do not untie the strings," thoughtlessly, hadn't I again made up my mind to do it? And now, here I was, less than a day later, my mind vacillating, wondering why I had to be in this place, in this pitiful state. I think none of us has been treated like this, to come into this Zen center. I think that the human will is very weak indeed. Without having disciplined oneself, one cannot trust one's own willpower. It is very easy to waver. When I saw my own wavering, I understood for the first time the significance of being made to keep crawling back into the entrance hall. This repeated crawling back is called being kept standing in the garden. Wasn't standing, it was frustration. Kept standing in the garden, the monk is faced to renew his original resolution, to strengthen that resolution, to resolve again, to bolster that resolution still further. It is for this reason that he's kept at bay before the entrance hall. All my teeth, not so strong to begin with, felt loose, and the blood surged to my face. I thought my eyes were going to pop out of my skull. My lower back, which had been bent so long in prostration, would break loose at the sockets. It was still cold when I arrived at the meditation hall on the 1st of March, as winter was particularly bitter in Kyoto that year. The chill commenced at my toes, pierced my feet, which were wrapped in wet sandals, and stole its way above my knees, so that all feeling in my legs was lost. To take the unsettled self in hand, under whatever conditions, and return to the mind with which one set out, to pick oneself up again and again, until after the mind changes, weakens and breaks down, and stiffens the determination to carry through the oft-reconstructed original vow. Isn't this the meaning of courage? I guess there were times when they had many, many, many applications. People wanted to be in a monastery. Times of famine, times of hunger. Or times where there was no future, in feudal Japan, I would love to say that it was always because of aspiration. I'm sure it wasn't always the case. Also here he's applying to one of the best known temples in Japan, which probably has a harsher treatment for someone coming, a new person. And I wondered myself, what would I have done if to enter the way I had to do that? I had never dreamed of following a spiritual path. Get into a religion. I simply tripped over. Landed at the door of Roshi Kaplo. And we became kind of good companions. Take walks. Take a walk every weekend. Twice every weekend. Saturdays and Sundays in the afternoon we would take walks in the mountains of Tepoztlán. It's a delightful person to be with. Very, very easy going in his speech, in his conversation rather. He was interesting, engaging, interested in the other person, I mean, he always welcomed someone to walk with, because both his attendants were kind of wary of being with him. They were with him all day long, and they were grateful for someone else to come and walk with him. And even though if we went all together, I ended up walking next to Roshi, Kaploa, and the future Roshi, who was Bodhin only at that time. He was happy to either go in front or go in the back. And Roshi Kaploa was, as I heard later on, or during those days as well, became friends with Bodhin. I heard his side, and other attendants, which I met in other trips he did. And some of them complained somewhat about the harshness of the treatment. And it was difficult for me to put together these two people as one. One that scolded, one that was kind. And yes, later on I saw that he did scold people. And he could be quite to the point, and he knew your weak points and lunged for them. And I always wondered if it was, how intentional it was, how much was it the training, it's how you have to be, and he learned it in Japan, how much he himself was strict and demanding of the conduct of others. But he never was like that with me, so he never really scolded me the way I saw him scold others. Now and then he would say something, well, come on. But nothing more than that. So it varies, and I'm sure each one of you has a different story about our teacher, about me, about other people, because each person relates to the teacher in different ways, and the teacher reacts to different people in different ways. After all, we're all different. And here we get to the teaching about the entrance. Waiting outside the entrance, this chapter of what am I doing here? Waiting outside that entrance, I was forced to revise my definition of courage. When I was young, I would try to demonstrate my bravery by attacking others. But this is not courage. Such aggression is, rather, like that of a puny dog with a loud bark. The bravery is pulling together one's weak mind and holding to one's original purpose. In order to maintain that hold, one must question oneself. What am I doing here? While I was kept standing in the garden, a variety of thoughts drifted through my mind. I reflected that each person who finds his way into his training hall to practice is born differently from others. Each one comes into the world with different abilities, has different experiences and education, thinks different thoughts. No two are alike. If every one of the multifarious individuals who entered the training hall were to assert their own way, to insist that this is what I think, how I do it, how on earth could practice go on? Yeah, there has to be a standard. As the saying goes, pour new wine into new wineskins. If it is with an eye toward self-transformation through practice that one pours one's body into training hall, the new vessel, then it is necessary to first throw down all of one's past experiences, knowledge, and social status. One must become completely empty and enter the training hall with a humble and meek heart. In the corner before the entrance hall, the novice monk is forced to think all of this through and prepare to act accordingly. So they're asking you to throw down all the one's past experiences, knowledge, social status. One must become completely empty. And enter the training hall with a humble and meek heart. To throw away all our past experiences all the achievements we think of, which make us feel important, but also, ideally, all the hurts, all the pain-producing experiences, everything that has scarred us, has left a wound that may be still festering in ourselves. All our knowledge, or our knowledge of who we are, is what is meant by the social status, who we are, what I am, this I. He came recommended by the former head of the temple, so I'm sure he pulled a few strings, or at least advised that he was sending this monk. Yet, He still had to do the process. And knowledge. One must go into Sesshin, ideally, with a clean slate, leaving everything behind. And take advantage of Sesshin, especially the first days, to finish up cleaning and throwing away everything that has to be thrown away. Of the sense of I. Of achievements, of injuries. The sense of self-importance. Of course, that applies to myself as well. In another tradition, when you become a teacher, the first thing you're asked to do is to drop the sense of self-importance of becoming a teacher. You're willing to carry the responsibility but not the fame that might come with it, or the sense of self-importance that comes with it. And that happens . It's something we all have to work on, regardless of who we are, how long we've been practicing. We need to become completely empty. You must be completely empty. And yesterday I was trying to be explicit that when we deeply concentrate, when you're totally concentrated on your practice, you're in a mind state where you are completely empty. You narrowly focus in your practice, leaving everything out. Then simply concentrate into this practice, and so everything else is left out. You become empty, and just by concentrating, even if you don't have an awakening, just this concentration allows a lot of the stuff we have stored away in our unconscious mind in this memory storage area of our brain allows a lot of that to just simply float away. Simply gets erased, delete, gone. Just by concentrating, you go cleaning your own self. It becomes more empty. As you practice, concentrate more, the emptier it gets. When you get to the bottom, and let me say there's no bottom to how much you can concentrate. Then you can aspire to awaken. Now this takes a totally alert state. You can't be concentrated when you're half asleep, half unconscious, half here or neither here nor there. You can break, you can go through sleepiness if you start being sleepy. When you begin to concentrate, the sleepiness goes away. But if you're in a kind of hazy mind state, where everything is kind of a blur in the midst of mist, and you're walking like in a swamp, feeling that you get stuck every step, your mind is not clear, and you gotta push to concentrate. You can't be dozing off and concentrated and be concentrated. Gotta be awake. You can't just start to concentrate and then say, wait, I forgot something. That doesn't work either. We don't know how to concentrate, that's the truth. We have to do it by trial and error. And I know some of you have been trying for quite a time. And I don't know what the obstruction is, but one gets to one point and one feels one can't get through it. That's as deep as I get. That's as high as I climb. No, that's not true. We can all go deeper. We just have to find a way to do it. To go around the obstruction. And if we persevere, we look for new ways of concentrating or coming back to it and back to it and back to it and back to it and again back to it, it will yield. It will. But many times our belief system deep inside us, there's no, you can't get through there. Well, how about there? No, not there either. Well, here? No. Too dangerous. Oh, no, there, no. We have a secret hidden there. And there? No. So you go back and to the surface and say, okay, I'll try again and go back and just gotta persevere. Keep going. I know it, I've been there. It just takes all you've got. Clear your mind. Push away the sleepiness, the confusion, the pain it produces, the fear of touching soft spots in ourselves. The fear to bring to surface painful memories. All that we have to go through. One point or another. And not because we necessarily have something very hidden, very painful, but the ego makes us believe that. Our sense of I makes us believe that. Our cherished self wants us to stop now, not one more step. I don't care. I'm going through. If it hurts, it hurts. There's pain. If my knees hurt, they hurt. Yes. Okay, let's use them. Let's use that pain, that energy, that determination. Keep reading the last of the chapter. On the evening of my third day to be held standing in the garden, a monk appeared to deliver a message. It has been observed that since the day before yesterday, you have remained as you are before the entranceway, even when being subjected to verbal abuse and physical assault. Oh, they recognize it. Been subjected to verbal abuse and physical assault. It has been determined that you do seem to harbor some measure of a desire to practice. What would you do if you applied for a job and they say, well, maybe you seem to have some abilities that might help you to sweep the grounds. I think you'd be too happy. For this reason, you are requested to step inside. However, as you have not been formally granted permission to train here, you are advised to remain on your guard. These were the words with which I finally made it through the front door. The room I was allowed to enter was composed of a wall on one side and paper doors left wide open on the other three sides. I placed the box that I had carried on my back before the wall, and facing the wall I began to do zazen. I had no way of knowing who might be looking at me from the other three directions. I could not afford to be careless. I was served three meals a day and given bedding each night, but I was kept in this room for five more days. Thus I was subjected to a total of 8 days of intense self-inquiry. I asked myself over and over, what am I doing here? What is it I am going to do? Under the force of my own questioning, I was compelled to revert always to the starting point, to the heart with which I had set out. Again and again, I returned to the takeoff point. Over and over, I reiterated my original resolve. I believe that courage is upholding what you have once decided to do, and enduring all troubles encounter along the way to sustain and carry out that original intention. Just this in itself is real courage. You've heard the encouraging words too. Just this. Everything else out. Everything has to go out. Everything. You cannot awaken thinking I have pain. Now awaken thinking I am sleepy. Cannot awaken wondering when is lunchtime. You cannot awaken wondering when the bell is going to ring. You cannot awaken if you're on the surface. You cannot awaken if you let your emotions take over. I used to have a student, when I pressed, I don't want to know how you feel, I want to know about your practice. He was so into his feelings. I say, if I don't tell you how I feel, how are you going to know how I am? You could change it for what I think, what I understand. I want to know what you understand. I want to see your awakening. I don't want to see how you feel, understand your feelings. I might indulge in that and help get through the feelings. But you don't get through feelings or through thoughts or through mind states. Accept concentration. Don't fool yourselves. Don't buy the wrong ticket. A told many of you that a pinch of curiosity, a little bit of curiosity, will help you engage in your koan. Stop making it dry. It has to be just a little bit, otherwise one gets distracted with inventing questions and going here and going there and running all around. If it's also just a dry moo, won't work. You have to want to know what mu is. If you just repeat mu, it will help to concentrate. But it gets only to a certain point. You want to know. When I had my first insight to mu, I just come to Sesshin in April. My wife was pregnant. This baby was due in October. And I knew I wouldn't be able to come back before a year. Between the pregnancy and new baby and the whole experience, I knew at least a year. And so she said, "When are you coming back?" And I said, "Probably in a year, the earliest." Said, "Well, why, unless your business is going broke or your house is falling down, come to the next one. It's in a month. It's in Santa Fe." So I hopped on the plane. And luckily, there were four of us in a room. And out of the four, we all found that I would go back to the room, I saw no one there. It's too early. I would go back to the Zendo. More Yaza. And one of them, the other four, would come back and see no one there. It's too early. Go back. And so that kept us going. Finding no one in the room till one of us collapsed and said, "Okay, I don't care. And I need to sleep a little bit." So one would go to bed and then the rest would kind of sneak in. But it was very inspiring to see for the out of the four, three had an insight. And we all later on talked and said, "Wow, I thank you three for just keep going. Just to show me that can be done." And the others said, looked back and said, "Well, I say the same of you." And so we all mirrored this, "Let's do it." And I knew I didn't have a chance to go back. And I wanted to know what mu was. I knew I couldn't go back sometime. And my practice would be different if I saw into mu. And that's exactly what we did. We helped each other. We focused. We worked as a group, not knowingly. We respected our neighbor, the practice of others. we had the determination, the will to just look into Mu and be in Mu and just concentrate. I don't care what happens. That's why it's so painful to see someone carelessly getting distracted in the zendo, because he drains the effort of others. Just drains it, or sucks its energy in. Takes the yuriki. There's plenty for everyone. Don't worry. But it's painful. Someone who is careless about his practice. When everybody's doing the utmost he can, she can, find that someone is not really there. So, as her pointed out, our bodies are accustomed to 7 days. They haven't heard, the body hasn't heard 6 days. So, today is day 4, not 3. We want to cover the same distance, we have to pick up the pace. So make this day 4, next day 5 and 6 and 7, or just go deeper, put more energy into your practice, get hold of it. Well, I'll stop this. Too many words can get in the way, can spoil the soup. So let's have the 4 vowels.